Welcome to the Heart of Our Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Heart of Our Messianic Ministries director, Pastor Bob Morris, will continue tracing the events in modern history that we call the Modern Zionist Movement. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 5. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Well, let's begin lesson 5 of our study, The First Regathering, The State of Modern Israel. I want to start with a little bit of a review. We began our lesson 4 last time with an historical overview of the period, and then we moved into a study of Zionism itself, starting in 1839 with Judah Alkali and his revolutionary thoughts. In 1840, the Damascus blood libel influenced Alkali to continue pressing for Jewish presence in the land of Israel. He was supported by Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer at that same time. And the in 1856, the Hayeshuv Hayeshan, the old settlement, got started with about 17,000 Jewish people back in the Holy Land, surviving off the Chalukah charity system. We also looked at Moses Hess in 1862 with his book Rome and Jerusalem. We saw that the plot of the Seven was purchased, the first independent purchase of land outside of the city of Jerusalem by Orthodox settlers. In 1870, Mikvah Yisrael was founded. In the late 1870s, we saw the beginning of the Chovev Etzion movement in Russia, with the Chovev Etzion being the lovers of Zion and the Chibat Zion, those who love Zion, forming little parties, little assemblies all over the place in Russia, all aimed at promoting Jewish movement back into the Holy Land. Well, let's pick up session 5 now with Petach Tikva, founded in 1878. We'll pick up in 1878. Actually, the formation of Petach Tikva starts a little earlier than 1878. It starts in 1875, 3 years earlier, when Joel Moish Solomon, remember he's the fellow that spearheaded the purchase of Nachlat Shiva, the plot of the Seven, in 1875, Joel Moish Solomon embarked on a quest for farmland. It took him 3 years. And in 1878, an available tract of land was located and purchased in the Sharon Valley, about 6 miles from Jaffa. It was a very wild and desolate stretch of land. It lacked roads. It lacked any assurance of Ottoman police protection. But the soil appeared fertile, and water was available from the nearby Yarkon River. So they erected mud huts for 26 starter families, 26 initial families. And so Solomon and his companions dubbed the settlement Petach Tikva, Portal of Hope, Door of Hope. Unfortunately, the river was not only a source of water, but it was also a source of mosquitoes. And during the project's first year, many of the farmers were struck down by malaria. Some died. Others were deserted by their families. And until the first grain harvest, the survivors were continually racked by hunger and disease. When the crops were reaped, they found no market to sell their crops among the Jews of Jerusalem. These religious leaders in Jerusalem were unforgiving of Solomon's heresy. This was radical stuff that they did not agree with. In the second year, the Yarkon River flooded the settlement. And by now, the Jewish farmers were broken in body and spirit. So they abandoned their effort and they returned to Jerusalem, and Petach Tikva lapsed back into wilderness. In that same year, 1878, Judah Alkali died. In 1881, we come to a very significant year in the history of Israel. Eliezer ben Yehuda arrived in Israel in 1881. Now, during the years prior to World War I, a crucial linguistic framework was being established for the Zionist redemptive effort. Now, while Hebrew studies did exist outside the land, Hebrew cities did exist outside the land under the Chovevi Zion groups. They were virtually, in contrast, non-existent in Israel itself, in the Holy Land itself. So the emergence of modern Hebrew, the modern Hebrew that we speak today, a language capable of secular vernacular use, awaited the heroic efforts, the heroic achievements of a little Russian Jewish philologist named Eliezer Perlman. He adopted a surname, Eliezer ben Yehuda, and he became well known under that title, Eliezer ben Yehuda. He was born to Orthodox parents, and he received a religious education. Eliezer, however, joined the thousands of his generation that turned away from pietism to Haskalah secularism. The Haskalah movement was a Jewish philosophical movement in Europe that stressed secularism and assimilation. From Haskalah, Eliezer then turned to Zionism. His vision of language was that language was a decisive component in modern nationhood. And this revelation, this vision, awaited his years of study as a student in the Sorbonne. He became acutely conscious of the role of literature in the growth of French nationalism, and he wrote in 1880, he wrote to his fiancée in 1880, "I have decided that in order to have our own land and political life, it is also necessary we have a language to hold us together. That language is Hebrew, but not the Hebrew of the rabbis and scholars. We must have a language, a Hebrew language, in which we can conduct the business of life." In the following year, 1881, Ben Yehuda, 23 years old, married his fiancée, age 27, a few years older than him, and they departed for Israel. From the moment they boarded the ship, they vowed to speak no other language but Hebrew, and that pledge was never broken. Now, the couple's next years in Israel were poverty-stricken. In Jerusalem, Ben Yehuda earned a pittance teaching Hebrew for an alliance school. His every free moment, however, was devoted to editing a succession of Hebrew language newspapers. In the 1880s, the circulation of these newspapers barely exceeded 200. There were occasions when he and his family were evicted from their room for lack of rent money. At times, they nearly starved. Ben Yehuda did not make the situation easier because he incessantly attacked the Orthodox. He constantly upbraided them for their opposition to secular Hebrew, secular labor, and for fostering the halukah, the charity community. He called halukah a social crime. Now, the Orthodox retaliated by stoning his office and denouncing him to the Ottoman authorities for treason. He was once briefly jailed. They also placed him under the rabbinical ban of excommunication. His wife died in 1891 of tuberculosis, and the Orthodox refused her burial in the Ashkenazic seminary. Nevertheless, Ben Yehuda's work began to have an impact in spite of all the troubles. Soon, all the agricultural colonies subscribed to his newspapers and purchased his textbooks. He became a power in the yeshuv, and eventually he became a power in the Zionist world at large. By the turn of the century, he was well launched on the project that would absorb the remainder of his life, the creation of a modern Hebrew dictionary. Pursuing his research with books and other materials sent to him by disciples in Europe, he relentlessly tracked down Semitic roots of words that ultimately were incorporated into the contemporary language. By 1904, he was modestly endowed by grants from Jewish sources, and he published the first volume of the dictionary. It was virtually an encyclopedia of the Hebrew language. It was a monumental work of scholarship. He would complete 3 more volumes before he died. Afterward, the undertaking would be expanded by his successors into a 17-volume series. It became the definitive basis for a revived, spoken, and written Hebrew language. By 1916, the fulfillment of Ben Yehuda's dream was in sight. A census that year indicated that 40% of the yeshiva's population spoke Hebrew as their first language. This little guy's accomplishment was formidable. It was widely recognized. When Ben Yehuda died in Jerusalem in December of 1922, 30,000 people escorted his body to his grave, and Israel's Jewish population observed 3 days of official mourning. Eliezer Ben Yehuda had a tremendous impact on the formation of the modern state of Israel. Let's move on to 1882. Now, 1 year after Ben Yehuda and his wife arrived in Israel, 1 year after they began their years of poverty, another significant Zionist appeared on the scene named Leo Pinsker. Now, Leo Pinsker was the son of an enlightened family in Odessa, Russia. Odessa was the nerve center of mid-19th century Haskalah. In the 1860s, Pinsker's vision of a Jewish future was consistent with that of the Haskalah. It was one of cultural self-expression within a pluralistic Russia. In 1871, an anti-Jewish outbreak briefly exploded in Odessa. Pinsker was deeply unsettled by the episode, and as a result, he withdrew from all public activities. All Jewish public activities. He withdrew for 7 years and brooded. He brooded over the evident failure of this cherished ideal of enlightenment, that there could be cultural self-expression within a pluralistic society. Eventually, he organized his writings, his views, I should say, he organized his views into writing, and he published a lengthy essay in 1882 entitled Auto-Emancipation. Now, in this work, Pinsker outlined his central idea. And his central idea went something like this. Normal dealing between peoples were founded on mutual respect, not love. It was unlikely, he felt, that the Jewish community could ever be accorded such respect because they lacked its prerequisite. That prerequisite, he felt, was national equality. He wrote, and I quote, "The Jewish people have no fatherland of its own, no center of gravity, no government of its own, no official representation," end quote. Rather, he said that the Jews were perceived as a kind of a phantom people, bearing many of the characteristics of nationhood, but without the final indispensable ingredient, a land of their own. And I quote him, there is something unnatural about a people without a territory, just as there is about a man without a shadow, unquote, end quote. Worse yet, he said, that as a phantom people, the Jews inspired fear among the non-Jewish majority. Whatever people feared, he felt, they hated. The solution to the Jewish condition lay not in reliance upon emancipation. That was a will-o'-the-wisp. That would never occur, Pinsker insisted. But, he said, the solution to the Jewish condition is a concerted attempt by the Jewish community to utilize their waning moment of opportunity to restore a national home of their own. Now, Pinsker attached no special importance to Israel, and I quote, "The piece of land might be small territory in North America or a sovereign pashalik in Asiatic Turkey," end quote. What counted for Pinsker was recognized state nationhood on a piece of land, any land. He didn't care where. Now, until Pinsker, the fact that Jews were very, very vulnerable as a homeless people had never been demonstrated systematically, and he did that. He did that in his work. For the first time, Jew hatred was analyzed as a deeply complex social phenomenon, bearing little relationship to education or project or progress in conventional terms. Now, almost immediately, auto-emancipation evoked a responsive chord among its readers. And very quickly, Pinsker became one of the most admired men in Russian Jewry. And for a while, he was the very heart of the young Zionist movement. In 1884, Pinsker set about organizing his nondescript collection of followers into a national movement. His followers were that unrecognized, unofficial, and illegal group of Zionist study circles and clubs known as the Chovevi Zion. Pinsker, by virtue of his prestige and by virtue of the general recognition that he was a natural leader in the growing Zionist movement, took the initiative. He would bring the Chovevi Zion group's organization and focus in 1884. Also during this time, between 1882 and 1903, 25,000 Jews entered Palestine. It was the single largest influx since the Spanish expulsion decree of 1492. Now, this upsurge in immigration is usually described as the first Aliyah, the first immigration wave. The term Aliyah comes from a Hebrew word that means to go up. And the term became a term describing immigration, to go up to the land, to make Aliyah. It consisted of two main waves, one from 1882 to 1884, and one from 1890 to 1891. Now, the first Aliyah immigrants came from Russia, and there are two main reasons for the first Aliyah. Number one, the Russian pogroms of 1881, the Russian persecution that erupted in the land of Russia against the Jewish people in 1881. And secondly, there was a renewed anti-Jewish policy in the Russian government that was reflected in its May laws. The May laws were published in May of 1882. The May laws imposed new political restrictions and disabilities on the Jews of Russia and brought to an abrupt end that era of liberalism under Tsar Alexander II. There was a decade of liberalism under Tsar Alexander II. That came to an end with the May laws of 1882. Now, these new developments caused many Jews in Russia to despair of any hope. They despaired of any hope of having a permanent improvement of their position in Russia. Then, Jewish people were expelled from Russia in 1891. And this provided a fresh impetus for Jewish immigration from Russia. This sent more Jews to Israel, and the first Aliyah came to a close. Now, the immigrants of the first Aliyah were mainly middle-class men. They were teachers, they were students, they were artisans, they were tradesmen. Some of these had enough financial means to enable them to settle in the country, and many of the immigrants came under the influence of the Chovevi Zion organization. All but 5% of the newcomers settled in the towns of Jerusalem, Jaffa, Hebron, and Haifa. So it was apparent at this time, evident at this time, that the unorganized Chovevi Zion organizations, while they had attracted many followers, were pretty ineffective agencies for immigration. And this led to the formation of an organization known as the Bilu. The Bilu is organized in Russia at this time. It was a group of youthful idealists who decided to take the initiative in establishing a foothold in Israel. In January of 1882, 30 young men and women gathered in Kharkov, Russia, in the lodgings of a university student, Israel Belkind. They came to discuss the plight of the nation. There they formed an emigration society, later known as the Bilu, a Hebrew biblical acrostic for House of Jacob, let us go. B-I-L-U, that's a Hebrew acrostic for House of Jacob, let us go. 19 of the young people made a commitment to abandon their studies, to abandon their professions, and make immediate departure to the land of Israel. The others promised to recruit new members and establish a model agricultural colony in Israel. In July 1882, they shifted their headquarters from Kharkov, Russia, to Odessa, Russia. At the end of July 1882, 17 members of the group sailed for Constantinople. From there, an advance guard of 13 men and 1 woman sailed for Israel. They reached Jaffa 5 days later. Intent upon securing a minimum of agricultural experience before launching their own farm. The young pioneers eventually received their first opportunity at Mikvah Yisrael, the training school that had been established 12 years earlier by the Alliance. However, the French teachers evidenced no sympathy for their ideals. The Biluites were driven mercilessly in their farm work. They were worked 11 to 12 hours a day until they neared collapse. One of them wrote, and I quote, "The overseers kept pressing us, giving us not a moment's rest. They had been instructed to drive this spirit of folly out of us and compel us to leave." Now, in the summer of 1882, the Biluites had little reason to be optimistic. Sickness was undermining their will to go on. They had no funds to enable them to develop a model colony of their own. Almost at the last moment, help materialized in the form of two Jerusalem Jews, Zalman Levantine and Joseph Feinberg. During the previous year, these men had collected money for land purchase from investors in Jerusalem and in Europe, and they managed to acquire 100 acres of land about 8 miles inland from Jaffa. Erecting their shacks there, they dubbed the new settlement Rishon LeZion, First to Zion. Now at this point, touched by the plight of the Biluites, Levantine and Feinberg persuaded the others to allow the youngsters to join the venture. And immediately, 11 of the Biluites took up shelter in the makeshift dormitory hut set aside for their use. Pooling their last resources, they cleared the soil, they planted maize and vegetables. Unfortunately, they weren't farmers. The harvest season had passed. After 2 months, both food and money were exhausted, and Rishon LeZion faced the very real threat of starvation. Completely dispirited, 5 of the original pioneer group decided to return to Mikvah Yisrael. 6 decided to return to Russia. At the same time, Petach Tikva, which had been abandoned several years earlier, was being resettled by newcomers from Europe. They fared no better than Rishon LeZion. Disease, heat, exhaustion, and robbery sapped their will and their resources. And the Jewish settlers were preparing to abandon what appeared to be a hopeless cause. Now we come to 1883 and the beginning of Baron Edmund Rothschild's help of Jewish settlements. You see, their rescue came from an unanticipated source, Baron Edmund de Rothschild. In the summer of 1882, he granted an audience to Joseph Feinberg, one of the two founders of Rishon LeZion. Feinberg had gone to Europe. He'd gone on a desperate fundraising effort to save the colony. Now, Rothschild was a rich and well-known banker. He was moved to tears by Feinberg's account of the pioneer's self-sacrifice, and immediately he offered 30,000 francs for the purpose of drilling a well at Rishon LeZion, and he implied that additional help would be forthcoming. Soon after that, Rothschild dispatched an expert French agronomist to Israel. He sent him to instruct the Bilu farmers, and he hired the director of Mikvah Yisrael, the Mikvah Yisrael school, as overseer of Rishon LeZion. In return for his help, Rothschild stipulated only that his contributions would not be made public. His wish was honored for many years. Somewhat cryptically, the settlers referred to their patron as Hanadiv Hayadua, the well-known benefactor. Well, Petach Tikva also turned to Rothschild for help. In 1888, 28 families relied on him for their daily income. However, Rothschild's support was not a blank check. It was not a blank check for the colonists to operate their farms according to their own judgment. The experts he sent in from France and from Mikvah Yisrael became his overseers. They became charged with the day-to-day administration of the settlements. And before long, a radical change took place in the farmer's status. Eventually, they were stripped of all authority to determine what crops they might plant and sell. This became the decision of the overseers. This kind of paternalism not only eroded the farmers' initiative, but it undermined their morale as well. They resented their dependence upon the caprice of the overseers. Although very well aware that they might starve without Rothschild's help, the colonists openly voiced bitterness at their transformation into serfs. The nine Biloites, continuing on at Rishon LeZion and Mikveh Yisrael, were fully as despairing under Rothschild's supervision as they had been under their earlier, hungrier days. 1884, Gedera is founded. But once again, in the fall of 1884, an alternative solution developed quite unexpectedly. Yechiel Pines, a Russian Jew who had immigrated to Israel in 1878, had brought with him a modest sum collected from the various Chovev Etzion groups. With this and other borrowed funds, Pines had established a craftsman society for the Biloites in Jerusalem in 1882. Now, with the remainder of the money, he purchased 700 acres of land near Yavne, a few miles inland from the coast. He turned that over to the Biloites. In December of 1884, their number reduced to 8. The Biloites set up a single wooden shack on the site, and they called the farm Gedera, which means sheepfold. Deprived of access to Rothschild's experts, the Bilu youths misplanted their subsistence crops, and at the end they were reduced to meals of radishes and potatoes. In the beginning of 1886, their situation was quite desperate. It appeared that Gedera would not survive. But Gedera did, in fact, survive, but only through the generosity of Baron Rothschild. The handful of settlers that remained abandoned the notion of a cooperative independent community. Like the colonists at Rishon LeZion, Petach Tikva, and other villages, they began to accept handouts from Paris. They began to hire cheap Arab labor. The original Biloites refused to endure this surrender. By the end of the 1880s, all of them had abandoned Gedera, some for the cities, some for Western Europe. Their experiment apparently had failed. Now we move to the Katowice Conference of Chibat Zion. It was apparent now that idealism, motivation, dedication, the three great characteristics of the Chovev Etzion groups, were inadequate to bring about independent immigration to the land. Something more was needed than idealism, motivation, and dedication. So at this point, Leo Pinsker took the initiative and summoned a national conference of the various Chovev Etzion societies. To circumvent the Russian authorities, the meeting was convened in Katowice, a German city. 34 delegates attended the initial gathering. They reached a consensus that financing Jewish settlement in Israel was their first priority. Only in the land of Israel, it was agreed, could the people of Israel be transformed into a viable society and nation. Now, the organization's central office was established in Odessa. As president there of the Chovev Etzion, Pinsker was charged with directing a growing stream of Jewish immigrants to the Holy Land. In the 1890s, the Chovev Etzion grew rapidly in many parts of Europe and overseas. Dr. Nathan Birnbaum, a leader of the movement, first coined the term Zionism. Now, pay attention to what I'm going to say, please. This is very important. By the time Theodor Herzl appeared on the scene in the 1890s, he encountered in Europe and in America the nucleus of a thoroughly respectable Zionist movement. It was already in place when Theodor Herzl made the scene. Its various societies, this Zionist movement's various societies, provided Theodor Herzl with the largest number of followers, including 90% of the delegates attending the first Zionist Congress in 1897. So God had laid quite a foundation from 1839 to the late 1890s when Theodor Herzl showed up on the scene. So I think this, when we see all the attention given to Theodor Herzl, I think this bit of information helps balance things out. God had prepared the Zionist movement and for Theodor Herzl, and it prepared Theodor Herzl for the Zionist movement. They went hand in glove. One was just as necessary as the other. Let's turn to 1889 now. And B'nai Moshe, founded by Achad Ha'am. B'nai Moshe, in 1889, was founded by Achad Ha'am. Now, in 1889, the Zionist dream of a Jewish national home was shaky. Now, this crisis was perceived at the very beginning by Asher Ginsburg. He was a leading member of the Chovev Tzion in Russia. He was born in the Ukraine to an Hasidic family. He was married off at age 17 to a girl he had never set his eyes on until the day of the wedding. Then he was locked in a modest family business in which he exhibited neither enthusiasm nor ability. He became an insatiable reader in virtually all European languages. Eventually, he took up residence in Odessa, which was a major Jewish intellectual center. Upon reaching Odessa, Ginsburg became an active member in Chovev Tzion. When he reached Odessa, then he became an active member in Chovev Tzion. He then began to devote his phenomenal scholarship to one cause, and that cause was the solution of the Jewish problem. Now, Ginsburg wrote under the pen name Achad Ha'am, one of the people, Achad Ha'am. In 1889, in an article entitled Lo Ze Derech, this is not the way, Achad Ha'am warned his fellow Zionists about the failure of Zionism's infiltrationist methods of establishing a Jewish homeland. This essay aroused widespread resentment among the members of the Chovev Tzion. He criticized their initial message as a failure. He insisted that the Jewish national revival in Europe by itself was not capable of supporting a major pioneering venture in the Holy Land. Only one course, one path was open, Achad Ha'am insisted, and this was it. He felt there was a need to mobilize the help of Western Jews in organizing an international society for building the Yishuv. Only a body such as this, was capable of negotiating a charter of Jewish settlement with the Ottoman Empire. And afterward, only an organization like this would be capable of buying and preparing land for systematic and orderly habitation. Well, like I said, the essay aroused widespread resentment among the members of Chovev Tzion, and Achad Ha'am was somewhat taken aback by the reaction, and he later modified his views. He proceeded to elaborate upon his conception of a land of Israel as essentially a national spiritual center for the revival of Judaism throughout the world. He felt this was the proper goal of the Zionist movement. His obsession with spiritual and cultural awakening began to have its impact, even among the practical Zionists. His pen name soon became the most important in the Zionist world. Chaim Weizmann once said this about him, and I quote, "He had the profoundest effect on Russian Jewish students in Europe. The appearance of one of Achad Ha'am's articles was always an event of prime importance. He was read and discussed endlessly. He was what Gandhi had been to many Indians, what Mazzini was to young Italy a century ago. It was to cultivate the spiritual cultural ideal that Achad Ha'am, in 1889, founded an elitist group, the B'nai Moshe, within Chovev Tzion. He founded B'nai Moshe to cultivate the spiritual cultural ideal within Zionism. Now, the society's accomplishments were important. It founded a national land purchasing fund, which later was handed over to the official Jewish National Fund. B'nai Moshe published a series of newspapers in Jaffa, giving accurate information on developments within the Yishuv. They established the first Hebrew language school, also in Jaffa, and later a collection of Hebrew libraries throughout Israel. They organized a nucleus of secular Hebrew-speaking day schools in Russia, as well as the influential Achi Asaf, Hebrew language publishing company. Achi Asaf is still publishing even today. So this Russian Jewish essayist became the conscience of tens of thousands of among the East European Jews who flocked to the Zionist movement. Ahad Ha'am was destined to become the most influential of cultural as well as distinguished from political Zionists. He was the most influential of cultural Zionists, and this is distinguished from political Zionists. Let's move to 1890. Rehovot and Hadera founded. Now, during the latter part of the 1890s, immigration to Israel slowed to a trickle. The Chovevi Zion organization itself remained in the doldrums. They were denied legal status in Russia and unable to collect funds. However, in 1890, the Tsarist regime permitted Chovevi Zion to begin conducting activities. And from 1890 on, the organization had a permanent office in Odessa. In 1890 and 91, as a result, 3,000 Russian and Romanian Jews departed for Israel. In 1890, the Odessa Committee, that's what the Chovevi Zion was known to the rest of the Zionist world, the Odessa Committee opened a bureau in Jaffa under the direction of Zvi Tiomkin. He was unimpressed by the Ottoman government. He was unfazed by the Ottoman government's restrictions. And he managed to purchase several tracts of land, large tracts of land, on behalf of Chovevi Zion. And he resold the land to settlers. And in this fashion, two important farm colonies, Rehovot and Hadera, came into Jewish hands outside the influence of the Rothschild administration. So we had independent settlements now getting set up in Israel. In 1894, we come to the Dreyfus Affair and Third Theodore Herzl. Now, Theodore Herzl was exceptionally striking in appearance. He had dark, burning eyes, chiseled features, and a big, rich Assyrian beard. His demeanor was also consciously aristocratic. His self-assurance was magisterial to the point of arrogance. Theodore Herzl was a unique personality. He was born in Budapest in 1860, the son of an affluent banking family. His parents maintained a nominal Jewish alliance, attending the Reform Temple each week, observing the major Jewish festivals. Theodore Herzl underwent a bar mitzvah. He even attended a Jewish communal school. Yet his ambitions were like those of his family's. His ambitions and those of his family were to excel in the realm of Jewish culture. He was an assimilationist. He wasn't interested in excelling in the realm of Jewish culture. He attended the University of Vienna. He enrolled in the Faculty of Law. Receiving his doctorate for jurisprudence for law in 1884, he accepted a quasi-official position in the Ministry of Justice. Virtually every free moment, however, was spent in the writing of plays and of literary essays. And before a year had passed, he had abandoned the law entirely. He loved writing. Herzl's chosen medium of expression was a popular European literary form that offered commentary on the social and cultural events of the time, and he became an instant success. In 1887, he took an editorial position with a newspaper and later held a senior editorial position. In 1891, he accepted the envied position of Paris correspondent for Austria's leading newspaper. Now, Herzl was increasingly preoccupied with the Jewish question. From 1892 on, his columns from Paris devoted increasing attention to anti-Semitism that he discovered in the French capital. So Herzl's despairing preoccupation with the Jewish question predated the Dreyfus Affair. However, it was markedly intensified by the arrest and degradation of that unfortunate French Jewish army captain. I think I will call our session to a close at this point in time. We're running out of time for this session, so let's close here. I'll pick up our next session with the Dreyfus affair and how it impacted Theodore Herzl.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Heart of Our Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's H-A-D-A-V-A-R at hadavar.org. Or write to Heart of Our Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries. If you're listening to this class on audio tape, please turn the tape over to begin the next lesson. If you're listening to this class on CD, the next lesson will begin in a moment.